As those of you who are regulars know that all year we've been studying this wonderful sutta, the Transcendental Dependent Arising, that starts with suffering and then moves to knowing that there's another option, moves to faith, and then we've got joy and happiness and rapture, and now we're in the month of tranquility. So tranquility is not a word that I often use, but words like easeful or quiet are really common to my practice. Because it's not a common word for me, I went and looked up the etymology, both of the English and of the Pali. So in the English, word tranquility is defined as quietness, stillness, or serenity, composure, and a lack of disturbance. The etymology is trans, meaning exceedingly, and kies, meaning rest or quiet. And the Pali is similar. The word is pasadi, and it's derived from the prefix pa, meaning forth, away, or intensity, and the root, to be quiet, calm down, or rest. It describes the allaying of mental and physical disturbances. Over the years, we've had teachers who took the noun anatta, or not self, and turned it into a verb of selfing. So I have found, as I've been working with tranquility, that I feel real comfortable turning it also into a verb of quieting, calming, allaying disturbances, easing, renouncing clinging, just that calming. So this morning I'd like to share some insights about calming and its opposites, like agitation, resistance, busyness, expectations. And I'm going to share a few experiences that I had recently. And from my sharing, I will touch on both some of the obstacles that prevent calming from arise and some of the conditions that we can cultivate as encouragement for the calming to surface and be present. I just returned from a month-long retreat at the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts. It's part of the Insight Meditation Society. For years, I've been hearing about the Forest Refuge and IMS, and I started to think of it as sort of the pinnacle of Dharma practice, the place that serious meditators go. And in addition, I have several friends who have sat retreats at the Forest Refuge, and they've been just exuberant in their tellings. And I know that their exuberance was just as a way of encouraging me. It took quite a bit of planning and organizing for me to go there. My son, who's part of my business, and I have been working for the last 2 years to find a way for me to retire. And finally, this winter, we have what we think is a good plan in place. We have three people who are covering the money part, the physical plant maintenance, and tenant relations. I have seven small business tenants at my place. So my son suggested some months ago that in order for our plan to succeed, I really needed to be gone at least a month. So I decided, oh, I'll go to the Forest Refuge and then I'll tack on another week or so of visits with friends. And as I reflect on it, while I greatly appreciated all of the support I got from my friends who had been at the Forest Refuge, I realized that I had internalized their experiences and transformed them into setting a very high bar for what should happen once I get there. I anticipated having this extraordinary experience. And even though I've been on a lot of retreats and I have a long-standing practice, somehow this one was going to be bigger, different, better. I was going to be bigger, different, better. And so Here I came to Forest Refuge. It was like going to the mothership. You know, IMS is where Vipassana practice in the West started when Joseph and Sharon and Jack came back from Asia and they started it there. It's also in some ways where Seattle Insight was birthed, because our founding teacher, Rodney Smith, after he came back from Asia, he did most of his training with Joseph Goldstein at IMS. And so I knew I was going to the Forest Refuge, and it's different from a regular retreat. There's not a schedule where you're supposed to be here at this time and there at that time. You're basically on your own. There was a morning chant, and then sometimes at 9 in the morning, one of the teachers would come and lead a meditation. Then there were two Dharma talks a week and two times to meet with a teacher. But other than that, you're just on your own, and you come and go how you want. Because I'd been practicing for so long, I thought, oh yeah, I'm up for this. So I arrived and I figured out where everything was, which took me a little few days. And then I got the staff to fix the thermostat in my room, which was permanently at 80 degrees. And I started sitting and walking and went to the early morning metta chant, which I even learned and started leading because the guy who was leading it left. And a funny thing, I downloaded this chant. It's not one that I had ever heard before. And I practiced it out in the woods and stuff, and then started leading it. And every Wednesday afternoon, if you want to, yogis can get together there and talk about their practice. So the first Wednesday after I started leading this chant, this guy was in this room and he made it very clear that I was doing it wrong. But be that as it may, I still had a really good chant, a really good time leading this metta chant. So I'm sitting and walking and doing my thing, but as will happen, before I knew it, the mind started to evaluate my experience and what was happening there and giving me a grade. And I was not receiving very high marks. And before I knew it, I was hit with this full-blown hindrance attack of doubt. Most of the doubt was turned inward, but it also morphed into doubting some of the basic teachings themselves. Here I was at the Forest Refuge, ready to have an important, life-changing experience, and it wasn't like that at all. So at the Forest Refuge, it's a lovely wooded place and with this nice building and all that, and there are all these Buddha statues everywhere. So I would find in those early days with my full-blown hindrance attack of doubt, I would go out and stand in this one field where there was this big Buddha statue, and I'd start talking to him. And it's true, I broke silence, but the Buddha statue of stone and rock didn't seem to mind. So I said, "So Buddha, what are we going to do with this half-assed meditator here?" I just felt like I had failed, that the experience was so-so, and I was a little bit less than so-so. So one of my first interviews with a teacher, I shared what was going on. She was very encouraging. She even offered some great humor. She said, "Oh yeah, we've been noticing that you're just a run-of-the-mill meditator. We're thinking of kicking you out." You know, so it was just great that she kind of made light of this doubt attack. And while I appreciated it, the doubt and accompanying disappointment continued. I was in a really bad place. I so felt the pain of doubt. For me, the Dharma is such a significant part of my life. What if this doubt was going to continue? What did it mean for me with my life going forward? Did it mean that I had to stop sharing the Dharma, that I couldn't teach anymore on Sundays? What if I discovered that I actually didn't believe most of these teachings? And what would it mean for my life? Could I be okay with that? You know what happens. Doubt arises and then the mind just goes whoosh. So my whooshing was full blown. So in addition to doubt and disappointment, then I added a whole bunch of fear. But fortunately, when I first arrived at Forest Refuge, I drew a little picture in my journal. And on this picture, there were like 5 or 7 or 8, since there's only 5 fingers, we're going to call them 5 pathways. And one of them went just straight, and there was a dead end at the end, and it said fear. And then there were 4 or 6 or 7 that went all over the place, and I wrote curiosity on them all. So I had come there with kind of a good intention. So here I am, filled with doubt, disappointment, and fear. But then there was this curiosity which kind of showed up as faith. Maybe there was a way out of this. So let me see. I just kind of went off and ad-libbed, and let me just see where I was. Okay. So one of the good things is that I didn't jump over how bad I felt. I didn't rationalize it. I didn't say, oh, this will pass too. You know how we sometimes use anicca, impermanence, in a bad way of like avoiding what's really there by saying, oh, this is going to go away, so chill out. I didn't do any of that. I fully felt the pain of what was there. And then one morning on a walk, I thought about my experience and realized that at least the schedule I was following was really felt very normal, very familiar. Being on retreat, in a way, was really a lot like my life at home. I get up early, I shower, I make coffee, I watch the sunrise if I can. I walk, I sit, I eat, I use the restroom, and then you repeat it all. And because I live alone, I'm really used to not talking to people in much of the day unless I initiate that. So what I was seeing on my walks, certainly what I was seeing was different because I was on the East Coast and the trees are different, the birds are different, but there was something so ordinary about what I was experiencing. And I think out of that ordinariness, I realized that I had imposed these unrealistic expectations that something special, something extraordinary was going to happen out of this very ordinary sitting, walking, listening to Dharma, doing a little reading of Dharma, eating, pooping, sleeping, you know, all the usual stuff. And not only had I created this big expectation about the experience, I created this huge expectation for me that I was going to be something, that I was going to turn, my meditation was going to become so different, and my teaching was going to change, and life was going to change. And so I looked at these expectations I had set. I had set the bar so high for the kind of retreat I was supposed to have and the kind of person, the kind of meditator I was supposed to be. At the Forest Refuge, there's this lovely little library, and they actually encourage you can take out books. So I checked out one of Ajahn Sucitto's books. It's a collection of his teachings. And in it, one day while I'm in the midst of this doubt attack, I read, if you're feeling inadequate, keep lowering the bar until you get to a place where you can feel some joy and courage in your practice. You rise up to the practice rather than dragging yourself up. Well, as you know, I was trying to drag myself up to these expectations for something special and extraordinary. And I had set the bar so high, and the idea of lowering it, I did, something inside me knew that it was a good idea, but it felt really revolutionary to me. But I could look at the courage and joy piece, and I knew that I've experienced it many times and that it was available to me again. So to start that search for courage and joy, the first thing I needed to do is let go of these expectations for the retreat. And for me, and just kind of allow the moments to be what the moments were. So over these years, certainly the last 8 years, I've shared so many times with you all the mantra that I developed after my partner Bill died suddenly. And that mantra is, may I trust in the natural unfolding of life, and may I receive that unfolding with wisdom and understanding. But here I was on retreat, and I think I left my mantra at home. So in talking with one of the teachers, I shared with her my mantra, and she said, well, she wrote it all down, and she gave me the piece of paper, and I said, oh, right, that mantra is really helpful for me here on retreat. May I trust in the natural unfolding of this retreat, of this day, of this hour, of this moment. And it's not like the retreat never had any more difficult moments. But once I allowed the retreat to unfold as it was going to, everything calmed down. Body, mind, energy. And as I said a minute ago, it was really, I think my being able to access this kind of way out was partly because I allowed myself to fully feel the dukkha of what had happened. And I saw how I had created that dukkha. I saw my own role in it. And that honesty that I brought to it, and I think I was feeling so bad, I don't think there was any other option for me than to be really honest. Another experience from the retreat, which I want to share, is one day I was walking along and I stopped and I was aware of my body and I went, oh my goodness, my nervous system is so at ease. So I've been blessed with a high energy being all my life. But I've noticed how forward leaning I always am, thinking about the next thing. How can I be productive? How can I get things done? And at retreat, one of the lovely things for those of you who've been on retreat is there's absolutely nothing to do except that small little yogi chore for you and to show up. So there's really nothing to do. And I stood there on this pathway noticing what it felt like to have a quiet nervous system. There was no buzz. There was none of that slight agitation. I may have shared this before. When I first learned about the five hindrances and the one of restlessness, I didn't quite understand it because restless was kind of like my MO. It was the natural, what I felt was the natural way of my nervous system. It was always kind of on edge, ready, just what's the next thing? You know, let's make this happen. And so here I was on retreat with a quiet nervous system. And oh my goodness, did it ever feel good? I kind of stood there just relishing this sense, this body sense of ease and no buzz there. Once now that I've been home for a week, I've thought about that a lot. And one aspect of this buzzy nervous system has to do with hurrying. Many of you may have heard this. Years ago, Christina Feldman used to come every year and do non-residential retreats. And she told us about her year-long intention that she always set. And one year it was to make neutral people not neutral, but people she cared about. And then this other year, she made an intention to not hurry. And she said, it doesn't mean you don't move fast. It doesn't mean you don't get things done, but you don't hurry. And the other day I was walking over to one of my neighbors. We were going to go out. We were going to walk to coffee. And I was a little bit late. I left home too late. And I found myself just walking really fast and hurrying. And then I stopped and I just said, Suze, where are you going? What's the rush? What's happening? And do you think your friend's going to be mad at you if you're 2 minutes late? So I just kind of quieted that whole hurrying energy, walked slowly, deliberately. I got there fine. We had a nice time for coffee. So the last reflection I want to share is before I went on retreat, I had started to notice and something that I do all the time, and I started to practice renouncing it. And this thing I do all the time is this inner commentary about everything. I comment about the weather. I comment about you. I comment about how you're walking, what you're doing. I comment about the news. I comment. And before I went on retreat, I started using this phrase to myself, Suze, the world does not need your commentary. And more importantly, on retreat, I realized, what does this nonstop commentary do to the state of my mind? The mind is so filled with commentary that where's the ease in it? It's just busy and chattering and also feeding this sense of me and my opinions and my comments. Oh, they're so important, even though I wasn't sharing them with anybody. They weren't necessarily judgmental, but it was like, oh, what I have to say, what I think is important. So I know I'm going a little long. I have a little bit of a summary. So one other thing I wanted to say is that we all know that as Dharma students, that we only have a very limited control over what happens in life. Life unfolds as it does, whether we like it or not. But in the midst of that, we also know we have a lot of choice opportunities. And we realize that when strong emotions come up, if we feed them, then that's one thing that happens. And if we don't feed them, something very different happens. It's like when anger arises, it doesn't actually get any life unless I give it life. So when life presents itself, we can choose to be with it or not argue with it. We can choose to not get in a tizzy about it. And as a result, we actually have quite a bit of influence on whether this sense of calming can arise or not. So in summary, there's a lot of learnings that I've gotten from my retreat and just reflecting on it. I assume there's going to be more as things settle even more. So first, be really aware of the expectations that you set for life, for experiences, not just for our practice, but for work and relationships and for other people and for yourself. And reflecting on the words of Ajahn Suchito again, if you're feeling inadequate, keep lowering the bar until you get to a place where you can feel some joy and courage in your practice. You rise up to your practice rather than dragging yourself up. I love that. Second, be really alert to the desire to be somebody. In my case, I was trying to be some kind of special meditator. Third, when painful experiences arise, allow yourself, when you're able, because sometimes you're not, but if you're able in that moment to fully feel the pain of it, don't skip over the dukkha. So many possibilities for learning and arise out of it. Fourth, regularly reflect on how your practice is going. Look for the courage and joy. Fifth, I freely offer my mantra to anybody who would like it. May I trust in the natural unfolding of life, and may I receive that unfolding with wisdom and understanding. Sixth, celebrate the simplicity of our lives, the ordinariness. Most of us do have full and busy lives, work, parenting, relationships, taking care of homes, and all the challenges of living a lay life. But ask yourself, am I making things even more complicated? And if the answer is yes, explore some options for simplifying. Seven, pay attention to the energy level in your body. Is there that buzz? And do you operate with kind of a buzzy, agitated, nervous, always ready to get going to the next thing? Or is there a way through the energy in your body to encourage a more relaxed, calm, and settled one? Eight is kind of a repeat of something I said before, which is to regularly reflect in your practice and notice those moments of joy. I had one recently that just filled me with so much joy, I want to share it. So I sit on Wednesday mornings with some Dharma friends. And last Wednesday, there was just one woman there, and she asked about my retreat, and I shared a couple things. And in listening to her response, I realized the joy of having a Kalyanamita, a spiritual friend, a Dharma friend, someone who listens and really hears me and sees me. I felt such joy in my practice, joy in my insights from the retreat, joy in sharing those insights, joy in being willing to share that I had created all this dukkha for myself. She's done it too, so in her own way. So I felt safe in doing that. Joy in knowing that I got through that hindrance attack and I learned stuff. Joy in feeling how honest I had been with myself, and that I could, joy in knowing that I could learn from this. And just like the Brahma Viharas, which we've been taught by our teachers, the Brahma Viharas of kindness, compassion, joy, and equipoise live inside of us. So, I believe, does the quality of ease, quiet, and calm. We can either create obstacles that kind of tap those down, or we can cultivate the conditions for those qualities to surface and flourish. So in closing, I just want to thank you for your practice and your attention, and may your efforts be fruitful. May you experience many moments of calm, quiet, and ease in this life, just as it is. May you honestly look at where your mind is leading you. May you make choices that help create conditions of ease and quiet, rather than feeding those natural disturbances that so often arise. May we and all beings live with ease and joy. Thank you. So let's take a moment and just allow what were a lot of words, and hopefully not too many, but there was a lot of excitement that I felt as I knew Candace had texted me while I was on retreat. I think you signed up for the 17th. And I thought, when she texted me, I was in the midst of this mess. And I thought, hopefully by the 17th, I will have learned something from the mess. And I did, and I think I'm going to still keep learning. So last week there were small groups. So this week I think we'll just do a large group discussion, and As always, you know, we practice good listening. We ask ourselves that fabulous wait, W-A-I-T question, why am I talking? So we're being as thoughtful as we can be in what we want to share. We don't give advice to each other unless somebody says, hey folks, this is what's coming up. What are your thoughts? And just, so all you have to do, I can see everybody on my screen, so you can either go like this or use your, in the React button, you can raise your virtual hand and Zoom user. Good morning, Charlotte. Nice to see you. And feel free to unmute and please share.
Yes, thank you. Just one small thing that I really, I love the talk. Thank you. But there was one thing that came up for me, and that was anger reactions. And the other day, my hands don't grasp very well, but they're getting better. But it just wasn't working. And so I threw things around my apartment, and I scared my poor cat. She ran into the bedroom under the bed and wouldn't come out. And this was before she had her breakfast. Oh, man, that taught me a real valuable lesson that my anger affected another being. And it was pretty painful for her and for me. So
honey,
I've been very paying attention to that. So thank you for that. I'll go now.
So I was with my son when that phrase came up and what we were talking about, when I said, anger doesn't get any life until I give it life.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just a set of thoughts and energy and emotion. And when I give it life, then it almost has a life of its own, like you and your poor little kitty.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for so honestly sharing that. I think a lot of us can identify. Faith, please.
Thank you. First of all, so much of what you said really, really spoke to me this morning. It's just what I needed to hear. I realized that I have a big problem on my mind, and it's a big problem, and it is, but it's because I cannot control it. I can't fix it. And so I have a friend, actually, a relative of my husband, who has been homeless for a while, and she cannot seem to look for work. And I want to help. I used to be a career counselor, so I know how to do this, right? And so I've given her some things, and I've asked her about it, and I'm paying for some things. And of course, it's not moving the situation the way I want it to. She's still very lost. And so I'm right now, I've spent this whole weekend trying to think about how I can let it go. But of course, I've made that into a project also. So,
What?
What?
Yes. I'm sorry, I was interrupting you. Please.
No, well, welcome to my world. I relate to your style. I'm high energy, high buzz, high reactivity. So the basics of meditation for me is I'm not a physical thrower, but boy, I can spread my anger around the room. So my bird is cowering in his cage. I'm just saying all of that. But how do I accept, love her without helping the hell out of her. So there I am.
Wow. I think many of us have felt that desire to help comes from compassion. And one of my dear Dharma friends here may remember some of the phrases from, I think it's from the equanimity one, or maybe from the compute. Lyndall's shaking her head that, you know, I feel your pain, and I also recognize that you're in charge of your own life. And we will, either I will, because I'll ask Lauren and Lyndall, because they might be able to direct me to it. I can send you those phrases, which I think might be helpful in it. It's like how phrases sometimes can really help replace some of the chatter of, I want to fix it and I want it to look like this. And that's that, you know, fixing it in order to, which we bring. So that would be one thing that I would think of. And the other, which is a little more subtle, but the Buddha's words, this was about renunciation, that he looked at the benefit and the drawbacks, and he really felt inside, or this is, I'm projecting, but when I do it, I feel inside, what's the drawback for me in trying to fix this person and make her life the way I think it should be? What happens inside of me when I am so consumed with that fixing energy? And believing that what I know about your life is so much better than what you know. You know, so there's also that selfing. And what happens when we really sit with that, the drawbacks of it, and when you get a little glimpse of the letting go, and sometimes it's just the littlest thing, the littlest feeling of, what if I just loved her? And that's what I have to offer, is love and compassion. And when you feel that little bit of that glimpse of letting that go, also feel what that feels like and do a comparison. Those are my best ideas. So Lyndall and Lauren, I'm going to ask you to help me find those phrases. Thank you. Yeah. My housemate this morning was responsible for me putting into my talk at the end that ease and quiet and calm and tranquility lives in here. It's part of our natural being. And we can either set up obstacles so that they're squelched, or we can cultivate conditions that allow them to arise. And I really believe that. So, yes, Judith, please.
Yeah, well, I related to so many things that it's hard to know where to start. We seem to have many of the same patterns. I think one of the most stubborn for me has been the hurrying thing. Oh. But I've discovered that there are clues. One is spilling things. Another is running into things. oh yeah, I'm hurrying. I don't have to. You know, and the
clues.
Other,
thank you for the clues.
Yeah, because I need them, because otherwise it just takes over, right? And the other thing I was going to mention was the whole thing about so badly wanting to fix somebody's life, somebody you care about. And it occurred to me once that, because I kept thinking, why is upekkha, why is equanimity in with metta, karuna, and mudita? Ah, yes, because we send metta without attachment to the results, right? Mm-hmm. We send compassion without attachment to the results. This is somebody else's life. We can love them. We can send joy. We can send compassion. We can send loving kindness. But, you know, we have to do it without attachment to results. And that's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard, but there it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. As always, here we are, this gathering of all this wisdom that just like seeps out, and I so appreciate it. My clue about hurrying, for those of you who are younger, I'm sorry to tell you that your skin is going to get really thin. And as a result, if you hurry and you're walking around like this, the next thing you know, your skin is pulled back and there's blood on your arm. And I have done that so many times, and I have all these sweet little scars on my forearms from hurrying around and not paying attention to where I was. So there's my clue. Yeah. Calm and quiet and tranquility. Have people had moments of feeling that, whether it's in your practice or just as you're going through your days? And I know a lot of you have very full, busy lives. Yes, Andy, please share. Nice to have you.
Hi, it's good to see you all. I've been really similar with the feelings of tranquility. My brain is bouncing with ideas, so please bear with me. I have been really holding on to what you were saying about lowering that bar so you can start feeling those tastes of joy and just enjoyment in our days and our worlds. And I am losing absolutely every part of my train of thought. I have been in this transition going back to work. I've been on medical leave for the last 6 months, and I have been holding a really heavy attachment and anxiety around my own personal expectation of my healing and where I should be at, as well as my work expectations and my healing expectations from external standpoints. So I guess this is just emphasizing and also, or I've been really on this analysis of how can I feel joy and how can I continue to regulate and how can I not let this completely shock my nervous system back into everything it was before. So I am just really resonating with these parts that you're speaking on, like trusting the experience and the natural unfolding of our life, and just knowing that we have the tools, or I have the tools to navigate through what I know and what I don't know and what will happen in this experience and what I will learn, even if it's not the attached perception of what will happen that I'm holding on to right now.
Thank you, Andy, because people have shared this over the months, for years, that the path is a process. Things unfold and we learn things and then we forget them and then we have these moments and then we learn again and then we balance, and it's this process. And I so wish you well in the content of your process, because we all have a little different content, but yeah, it's and there's a trusting of the process, the trust that, you know, you're going to know that discernment is there inside of you, and you're going to know. And part we know when we slow down enough to give ourselves some time to think about it and go, oh, what's actually happening right now with this expectation about my healing and my work? And yeah.
I think it's the slowing down part, because I'm seeing myself get attached to the speed and the ramp up of that.
Goodness, the momentum. And this... living in this time, in this culture, there is that encouragement of having that momentum. Come on, girl, get moving, get it done, go, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I think it was Lyndall, then Lillian, and Nikhil, and then Sarah. Is that right? Yes, I think so. Hi, Lyndall.
Hi. Oh, thank you so much for that fabulous talk. I really enjoyed it and could relate to a lot of it. And I was just especially appreciative of you talking about the pain of having so many expectations. Because, I mean, I feel like, yeah, been there, done that. And one of the lessons that I have really learned on, especially on retreat, is if I have expectations about how things are going to go, I just set myself up to suffer.
Wow.
Yeah. And the stronger they are, you know, because we don't know. We really don't know. And this, I mean, I'm thinking maybe this is an especially important message right now when we're studying this transcendent dependent arising, and we might be looking at this and thinking, oh, I ought to be experiencing this, and my practice ought to be like this, and I need to make it be like this.
Yeah.
So it's really important to be willing to just be with what is.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing that bigger perspective, because I think there is an element of the transcendental dependent arising that can set everybody up for feeling like they're failing.
Yeah.
Wait a second. I'm not transcending anything. I'm stuck in wherever. Or whatever our minds are saying. So thank you for that reminder. Yeah. Lyndall and Nikhil. Hi, you two in Idaho. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for your talk, Sue. I connected a lot to something that you mentioned about the commentary, kind of a habit of mine that you've noticed recently. And I noticed something similar in myself. I mean, I was kind of investigating it a bit this week, actually, where there's a lot of times there's judgment in my mind about others. And even I noticed this week when the judgment falls away, there's sometimes just an absence of metta. And it was kind of striking to me that, you know, when I'm sitting and cultivating metta, I'm like really bringing it to the practice, it's there. But in these sort of like day-to-day interactions, I was noticing that it was a bit absent. So that's something I've been working with. And it also related to me somewhat about what Faith and Judith talked about separately, about, you know, kind of wanting others in our lives to do things a certain way. And I have a loved one who does things the way that I wish she would change. And I think to some extent there's the commentary there. There's this judgment. There's this remarking on how she's doing things, which it's not the way I would do things, but that doesn't mean it's the wrong way. And I think, yeah, just circling back to metta there, I think is probably something I can work with if I'm not there yet. So.
Oh. I think it's Ajahn Sumedho who defines metta in this super broad way of just allowing things to be as they are, which then means allowing people to be the way they are. Oh my goodness. And allowing us to be the way we are. And that quality of heart of allowing, I think it's really beautiful. And wish you well in this process, because it's not an easy one. That commenting just is there. Boy, isn't it? Sarah, please. Lillian, did I cut you off? Were you done? Okay, you're good. Okay. Hi, Sarah.
Sarah, you're muted.
You're still muted. There you go. There we go.
Thank you. As others have said, thank you so much. I really got a lot out of your talk this morning, and, you know, the parts of myself that can feel separate, it's just kind of wonderful to not feel so separate, and hearing other people kind of parallel a lot of my experiences. But one of the things that I really appreciate, other than so many good jewels in there, is just how you talked about how, you know, your mind kind of started with this expectation, but once you got into doubt, like, it didn't just stop with doubt, it kind of spiraled into this catastrophic thinking. And I'm kind of in a pattern of doing that right now. Yeah, it's hard. But You know, what I love too is within your talk, kind of your journey and how you worked with that to even in that time, cultivating what we call calm or tranquility, and the fact that you maybe even had moments of embodying it, you know, was such a great thing for me to hear, because that's what it's about. I mean, it's the not resisting is so hard when you don't feel good, but yeah, there's still that, the skill, the practice of cultivating tranquility. So I guess that's kind of what I'm just kind of new to this whole year study, but we're looking at the path from, you know, yeah, that challenging place to cultivating tranquility. And your talk just kind of, in my mind, was a great example of that. So,
well, thank you. And thank you. Back at you for noticing the spiraling. When we notice the mind spiraling, we can either go for that ride, or sometimes the noticing stops us for a moment and we go, oh, spiraling. Oh my goodness. Doubt, disappointment, fear, catastrophe. There I was. And so there's something kind of humorous about it. I mean, when I really listen to myself and I go, really, girl? Yeah. It's like the teacher said to me, yeah, we've noticed you're a mediocre meditator. We're going to kick you out of the forest refuge. It was kind of like that, the almost ridiculousness of the spiraling, that if we can see it. So thank you, Sarah. And Lauren, thank you.
I just want to say I thought about you a lot during the month, and I was wondering how it was going. And then you shared your retreat with us. And so I felt like I was there in a way. And I benefited very much from your sharing. I really, really appreciate you telling us in such depth what it was like. So I wanted to say that. And then I thought it was wonderful the way you took us all the way through that dukkha trip that you had, all that doubt, and the turning point where there was a faith that there is another way. And that was based on, you know, that's from your practice. Mm-hmm. So your practice stood you well, even though sometimes it feels like it's not there. It mm-hmm. is. And so that's the whole transcendental, beginning of the transcendental path. We saw it again. And I just love that. And the idea of what Ajahn Suchito shared about lowering your expectations so that you can feel the courage and the faith. And so that was a wonderful teaching for me. So yeah, thank you for sharing this.
You know, I'm so grateful for the years of practice, and thank you for that reminder that the practice did support me. It did show up. And, you know, partly that I read that line in Suchito's book and went, oh, he's talking to me, you know, that I could receive it. And there was an openness to, and I think, really, the faith of, somebody has said this many times before during this year, that believing that there's another way, that there's another doorway out there, that something, this feels terrible, but I know that there is something else. And that faith, which comes from keep practicing. Yeah. Thanks, Lauren.